Hi, welcome to One Foot in the Closet. I'm your host, Name Redacted, and I'm a queer polygender African who lives life with one foot in the closet for reasons of safety, only out to trusted friends and family, but never publicly out in the Western sense, because to do so would be unsafe, as in the country I currently live in, it is illegal to be queer and anything but cisgender. In this podcast, I will interview queer Africans, both on the continent and in the diaspora, who live like I do, with one foot in the closet. Each guest has chosen their own pseudonym, as we are trying to create as safe and engaging a space as possible. I believe conversations like this are not only important, but necessary to help provide a counter-narrative to the predominant Western narrative coming out. You don't have to have a bold public declaration to come out. You can exist with one foot in the closet for safety, like I do, and that's perfectly valid and deserves more representation. I would like to unpack the privilege of coming out through this podcast and how not everyone has access to this privilege. This podcast aims to give a platform to queer Africans to tell their own stories in their own words, in a way that is safe to them. Today, we welcome back Queer African Reads for part two of their interview.
I don't know, like, how do you feel? Especially in Uganda, in a country where there's so much backlash and, like, there's such active figureheads who are anti-queer. We don't have that here in Kenya. Like, very prominent people who are anti-LGBTQ. So what is it like for you guys?
Honestly, working on this podcast has given me a lot of hope. Because working on this podcast, I've been able to talk to a couple Ugandans who have told me about their experiences with being queer, navigating transitioning in Uganda, navigating, like, all these difficult experiences within a queerphobic society, but still being able to find a community, still being able to find people to help you on your journey, being able to find queer-friendly doctors, queer-friendly therapists.
Wow, yeah.
You know, and so, like, that's given me a lot of hope, honestly. I was more pessimistic going into this podcast, but interviewing the people that I've interviewed and hearing their stories and hearing the stories of how they've been able to find ways to not just survive, but thrive and, like, enjoy life. Yeah. And, like, find queer joy within a queerphobic society has been honestly, like, very, very inspiring and revolutionary for me, because I was under the impression that Uganda's, like, an incredibly queerphobic society, which it is, but there's also a lot of people doing a lot of really good work, especially at the grassroots level. There's, like, people who, like, take in queer homeless youth, provide them with a home and a place to stay, and a community of like-minded queer people who can get what they're going through. There's this project that I heard about through the podcast Afroqueer that works with parents and children who are queer and basically brings them together for, like, group therapy so that they can explain and, like, talk and have, like, a dialogue rather than it being, like, you know, oh, like, you're queer, like, you're evil, you're the devil, you're, you know, all these things. But, like, listening to that episode and listening to, like, the ways that the parents were actually able to change and, like, were able to, like, celebrate their children's queerness instead of denigrating it. And so, like, honestly, I'm hopeful. We do live in a very queerphobic society with a lot of figureheads who are incredibly queerphobic and, like, I mean, that all the memes of the eat the poo-poo, you know?
Oh, God. And that meme refuses to go away. That why are you gay meme? Like, it refuses to die. I hate it so much.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, especially being from Uganda, like, that's the only reference that a lot of people have for Uganda. And so every time Uganda comes up outside of Uganda, people are like, oh, eat the poo-poo. Oh, why are you gay? You
know? Oh, no.
That is not what my country should be known for. We have, like, a lot better exports than that. I mean, I'm grateful that, like, now Daniel Kaluuya is, like, award-winning and, like, you know, doing all these great things because, like, he's at least putting Uganda on the map in a way that is positive.
Yeah. Oh, I thought Yeah, I thought you were saying, because I was like, Daniel Kamy doesn't do anything for the queer community, but I see what you're saying. At least he's famous.
Yeah. At least he's like a famous Ugandan who, like, we can like say like he's Ugandan, like, and he's a reference point that like people can be like, oh yeah, so Uganda.
And he's like big time famous.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Yeah. And so that helps. But these podcast interviews that I've done have honestly given me a lot of hope, because like any community, it's all underground, you know, because it can't be out in the open. But there is a lot of great work being done at the grassroots level, which really gives me a lot of hope. I have a couple of queer friends, but like, you know, like I'm selective about like who I'm open to about my queerness, because safety, and I don't know whether I can trust them or not. And like, if I spend too long in their presence and they start saying hateful things toward queer people, then I'm like, that's like a clear sign that I can't trust you. Having the opportunity to do this podcast and interviewing people and seeing their experiences has honestly given me a lot of hope, even though society-wise and government-wise, it might be anti-queer. There is a lot of people doing a lot of good work on the grassroots level, which I'm grateful for, and providing a community for especially like young queer people. Because also like the problem with a lot of like queer communities is like it tends to be party focused, hookup focused, sex focused, you know?
Drugs, alcohol.
Exactly. But like these communities that I've been hearing about have been more so like watching movies, cooking dinner together, hanging out and talking about, you know, like their lives. And like, I feel like that is what like especially young people who are queer need in order to like feel like not as alone, but also as like an introduction to like the queer community that's not as potentially predatory, you know?
Right.
So something that you mentioned previously was how a lot of people both on the continent and off describe queerness as un-African. And this is despite existing for centuries on the continent. And this is a topic that I'm particularly passionate about, because I've found difficulties learning about queer African histories because of their erasure. So maybe you could help me and other listeners by providing resources about queer African histories that you know of and how they were so effectively erased by the colonizers.
Wiped out, right? I mean, and it's a very interesting moment to be having this conversation because of Queen Elizabeth kicking the bucket and people are like, she's so responsible for everything that went wrong with the continent. And other people are like, no, she's not. How dare you? So, I mean, yeah, as you very rightly mentioned, the reason why homosexuality, as the umbrella term that is normally used, is illegal on the continent is because of colonization and colonialism. Mm-hmm. And the fact that there were colonial era laws that were passed that are still, I mean, at least for Kenya and a few other countries I know, like the penal code that we have was written by the British.
Yeah, same in Uganda.
Right, exactly. So it's so funny, right? That we're still using these laws from like way back in the day. Mm-hmm. But what's actually ended up happening is that people are picking them up as if it's their culture, right? So these laws were passed less than, I was going to say less than 50, but it's actually more than 50 now. Just over 50 years ago, and people have decided that actually these were their cultures. It's not just laws that were passed the other day. Actually, we've been believing this from the very beginning. But when you actually do the research and the reading, then you find that that is truly not the case, right? That almost every community had its own queer practices, right? And I think when people think about queerness, like I said, they only think about homosexuality. So that's why it's like, oh, this thing is an African. But when we talk about the umbrella of queerness, it's not just about men having sex with men. There's so much that goes into queerness that is inherently criminalized by these laws, right? Mm-hmm. So if I were to give some book recommendations, I think like a lot of the work that's been done in that area is by white people, like anthropological works. So I'm thinking about a book like Boy Wives and Female Husbands.
I've heard of Boy Wives and Female Husbands. I've yet to read it, but I've heard it referenced several times.
Yeah, I've only read, let me see, I've only read like excerpts of it. Like I've not read it as extensively as I would have liked to, but that's like one of the really famous ones. Mm-hmm. And then I'm thinking about like The Invention of Women by Oyoronke Oyewumi, who is a big, like a huge Nigerian theorist who does great work on queerness and queer histories. And this goes beyond issues of who's having sex with who. This is discussing the invention of gender, which is, I think, really powerful work. Something else that I would mention, African Sexualities by Sylvia Tamale. Sylvia Tamale is a Ugandan.
Yeah, Team UG. She's here in Makara.
Team UG in the house. So there's the African Sexualities Reader, edited by her. And there's also research on gender and sexualities in Africa. So basically just anything by Sylvia Tamale, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm. My sister wrote her master's thesis on her work.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, she deserves it. Mm-hmm. For an African gender studies reader, it would be Oyoronke. So Oyoronke is queen of gender studies, and Sylvia Tamale is queen of sexuality studies, right? So I said boy wives and female husbands. There's another book called Male Daughters and Female Husbands, which is about gender and sex, but this is by an African, Ifi Amadiume. Boy Wives and Female Husbands is edited by Stephen Murray and Will Roscoe. I think I've mentioned like six books.
Right? Yeah, that's more than enough. You gave us a great reading list and a great bunch of resources to dive down. So I appreciate you for that.
Yeah. So if I were to rank like who to read first, I think it's always more important to read African histories from African people. So I would say probably Sylvia Tamale and Oyoronke Oyewumi are who to read first. Oh my gosh, I recently read a book called Knowing Women. It's a PhD thesis though. Knowing Women by, I forget what her name is, but that's the name of the book. And it's about lesbianism and lesbian histories in Ghana. Mm-hmm. So that's another one that I would recommend. Mm-hmm. The woman is half Ghanaian and half German, I believe. Mm-hmm. Oyoronke Wumi is from Nigeria. Sylvia Tamale is from Uganda. So I think that's like, it's going to give you a good like overview of how sexuality has evolved and gender have evolved on the African continent. One more person that I need to shout out, sorry, I just remembered. Mm-hmm, for sure. Is Sobonkusome. What is the name of her book? Let me see. So basically, Sobonkusome's book is about like African approaches to intimacy. The book is called The Spirit of Intimacy. And the final chapter is about like gay men being like the gatekeepers of heaven or something like that. How like in Burkina Faso culture, gay men have a special place in spirituality. So I found that so interesting. I know that's not what the book is about. So that's another one, like another one where, because Sobonkusome and her husband, who recently died, they're both scholars of like African tradition. So let me not say African tradition, that's a really broad stroke, but like Burkinabe tradition. So yeah, that's another one that I would mention. So that's another country. I just wanted to give you another country, not just these English-speaking countries, but that's, a Francophone country. Yeah.
That was a great list. Thank you so much for providing all those resources. So any of our listeners can feel free to check out any of those books, especially the ones by African writers. Anything else you want to get into in regards to queer African histories and their erasure?
You know, for me, like, I think initially when I was trying to figure out, like, why people say homosexuality is an African, When I was trying to dig deep and understand where that was coming from, and I was reading and trying to be like, oh, but this community does this and this community does that, and they've been doing it for hundreds of years. At that point, it mattered to me. I think now where I'm right now is, for me, it's so irrelevant. Like, whether we've been queer for centuries or not, none of that validates or invalidates whether it should be legal, you know? There's so many things that we do that are un-African. Like, imagine if you said socks are un-African. Mm-hmm. So what? I wear socks now. Like, who actually cares? You know? So I think initially in my journey to understanding queerness and African queerness, I was hell-bent on having the facts on my fingertips. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, it doesn't matter whether it's un-African or not. It's happening and you're going to get used to it, you know? I don't care. I actually don't care if somebody says queerness is un-African. So are a million other things. Laptops are un-African, but here we are having this conversation, but the internet is un-African, mm-hmm. right? Who cares?
And also beyond that, the fact that there are probably millions of queer people existing on the African continent makes queerness inherently African.
Literally. What does the word un-African mean to you? does this thing have to have existed for 5,000 years, 3,000, 1,000? Like, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. When does something become African? Like, the whole argument has no standing in various ways.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Wholeheartedly agree. All right. So our next question is, you wanted to discuss the importance or lack thereof of coming out of the proverbial closet, which is exactly why I started this podcast. So I'm glad you brought this up, because One Foot in the Closet is exactly about all these reasons and how a lot of us can't come out of the closet for reasons of safety. And coming out of the closet isn't safe for all of us. Could you elaborate on this?
Yeah, maybe coming out is un-African. Well, actually, I was watching, there's a YouTuber called Khadija Mbo, and they're, I don't want to get this wrong. They're from the Gambia. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure that's correct. And, you know, grew up in a Muslim Gambian family. And now they identify as non-binary. I know even in terms of sexuality, they're queer. And they did this video that really made me think about the importance or lack thereof of coming out, you know? And I think this is one of those Western media things where there was always that episode where the queer kid, you know, sits down the family and has a very serious conversation with them. And it's like, mom, dad, I'm gay. And they're like, we already knew that. And oh, we're going to love you anyway. And all those things. Or even if you watch the darker side of queer film, where it's like the kid who comes out and the family rejects. But the point is that there's always a coming out. There's always your mom and dad need to know that you're attracted to people of the same gender or, you know. And we're not talking about like coming out when like you're trans. That's a whole other thing altogether, right? But this idea that your mom and dad need to know that you're into men or you're into women or you're into both men and women. The point is that they need to know. And like, why, you know? So this idea of coming out, like, why is it so important in Western culture? And is it necessary? And as Africans, if we don't sit down our parents and tell them what type of queer we are, does it take anything away from our queerness? Or would it in fact be detrimental, right? Because you're growing up in these hyper-Christian cultures or hyper-Muslim, whatever religion is prevalent in the country. I mean, how many things don't your parents know about you? Like, you don't need to sit your mom and dad down and be like, mom, dad, I've tried ecstasy. You know, like, who cares? I mean, essentially, there's no need to sit them down and tell them that you're queer. I understand if it can, it could be important to some people that their parents know. But the more problematic thing there is this idea that you need to come out of the closet. Who does it serve, right? And what is the importance of, like, what does coming out change for you?
Definitely, because in a lot of cases, it can jeopardize your safety. Like, I'm not out to my parents, and that's because doing so would completely change the dynamic, because I know my parents' views on queerness, and they are not positive views, you know? Like, we've had discussions about it, and it's not been in a positive way. And it's difficult to be, like, to love somebody who you know is disgusted by a part of you, you know? But, like, at the same time, it's like, I'd rather keep the relationship the same way it is.
Exactly.
Rather than coming out and creating a whole lot of drama over something that doesn't, there doesn't need to be drama around, because this is my personal life. It's
my life. Exactly. It's my business.
Exactly. It's my business. And I'm only coming out to people who I trust. Like, I'm not coming out to like my entire family. I'm not coming out to even my friends who are queerphobic, you know? I can have these relationships with them, but it's like, we can be friends-ish, you know? It's difficult to be friends with somebody who like is queerphobic, more of an acquaintanceship, I suppose. But you can have these relationships with people and know that they either hate a part of you, but that's the same way I'm friends with people. A lot of people who are ableist, and it hurts to see, you know, people who call themselves my friends being ableist. But like, for me, it just like shows that you don't care about me in the fullness of my being. You might care about me like when I'm out and about and when I'm able to like do things. But like when like my disabilities come to the forefront of my life, you're not there for me. And so that just goes to show that you're not really a true friend. And so I just push those people to like the outer circle of more acquaintanceships. and the people who are actually there for me and who actually celebrate my disabilities and my queerness and my blackness and all these facets of me, those are the ones who I like really like invest in as far as friendship goes, because it's disheartening to see that a person that you care about can't handle a part of yourself.
Yeah. This is something also that I think about quite a lot, because I think like just prior to the pandemic and during the pandemic, I isolated myself so much because I was struggling with like depression and it became quite severe. And I don't think it's realistic to expect people to keep reaching out to you, say if you're ignoring them or you just don't have the mental capacity to respond to them. So I did end up losing a lot of friends along the way. And I also think about it a lot in the context of like relationships, because in 2016, my relationship and like my long-term relationship ended. But before it did, like, I remember that I was spending several hours in bed and my partner was like, let's go out like for months on end. And I'm like, no, I want to lie down here and watch YouTube. Like, and of course that's like detrimental to the relationship. Right. Mm-hmm. So I always think about it so much. Like, what would I expect and what are people capable of in a capitalist society? I always come back to that, because I'm like, there's a reason why people don't have patience for me. And that's because they live in a society where they're required to juggle 50 other things. And a lot of them are like, I'm not going to be able to deal with your bullshit because I'm already dealing with my bullshit, you know? So that's a topic. What I was trying to say is that that's a topic that really weighs heavy on me when I think about the people that have stuck around and the people that haven't, and how do I feel about people not sticking around? Yeah, it's so complicated.
How do you feel about people not sticking around?
I guess it depends on the day. Like, for the most part, I can be altruistic and be like, you know, I get it. We live in a society. but then some other times, like if I think about a particular person, then it hurts. I'm like, wow, this person used to be there and now they're not. Or they slowly stopped being in my life. They reached out less and less. And I wish they'd get it, but they don't. And now we're here. Friendship over. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Friendship breakups suck. I mean, they can be worse than relationship breakups in my experience.
All right. I don't even think I'd call it a friendship breakup, because sometimes like you're speaking less and less and less. And then the person who was in your life 100% of the time just isn't there anymore. And it's like, you know, I wish that I've never had like a big blowout. Mm-hmm. I wish I've had that. Like I wish it was final like that, you know, like, I can't believe you did this to me. And then you break up. I've never had that. It's just been like people lose patience and slowly drift away.
Mm-hmm. And that can hurt even more than the big blowout, because at least with the big blowout, yeah, you get closure, you know?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But this is like abandonment, mm-hmm, you know? Yeah,
that's very tough.
Yeah, anyway, but the point was, is there necessity in coming out? And especially if it's, I mean, the way coming out was sold to us is you come out for the sake of acceptance. You don't come out to be shunned. Mm-hmm. You come out when you already know what the outcome is, right? So then it becomes unnecessary for us to think of coming out as an important thing, because we know that often the reactions that we will receive in African society will not be positive. Mm-hmm. So there's no point in coming out. If coming out serves one purpose and one purpose only, which is to be accepted with open arms, then there's no need for me to do that.
Exactly, exactly. That relates very heavily to one of the main inspirations behind this podcast, is the web series Brown Girls by Fatima Asghar and Sam Bailey. And I remember watching that and the coming out scene, like being one of the only coming out scenes that I'd seen in media that depicted something very similar to my personal coming out scene.
Right.
Because the character came out to their sister, and their sister was like, we've known all along.
Exactly.
And then the character was like, don't tell auntie, you know? Which, like, I've never seen in any other media of, like, don't tell. Like, because this is a character who was raised by their auntie. And so, like,
right,
they're an orphan. And so they're raised by the auntie. And so, but it's like, don't tell, you know, the whoever the guardian is or the parent is in this situation.
Yeah.
Because they already know that they won't get it. And so there's no need to have that conversation in the first place. And that was the first time that I've seen that experience depicted in the media. And so that was a huge inspiration behind this podcast, because I wanted to have conversations with people who, like me, live life with one foot in the closet and who thrive and, you know, exist and are able to live great lives despite not being fully out in the Western sense, because there's this Western narrative of you have to come out to everyone and it has to be this whole big public shebang, you know, which like is not safe. It's not safe. Yeah.
And I think this ties into something else that I wanted to speak to you about, which was the privilege of pronouns.
Definitely. Because thank you for the segue. Yeah, I was about to get into it.
Right. I said I'm not touching on transness when I discuss the first aspect of coming out that I was discussing. But now I want to touch on transness because pronouns are a form of coming out, you know. Mm-hmm. And we live in a time where people are encouraged to have their pronouns like on everything so that people don't misgender you or people, you know, so that you can be addressed as you should be addressed. But for me, right from the beginning, it was so clear that pronouns are like, of course, pronouns help trans people who are out to be seen as who they are, but overwhelmingly, pronouns are a privilege of the cis, you know? So if I was cis and my company is like, we encourage you to share your pronouns, of course, I will happily put my pronouns in like my email signature or my bios or social media or whatever. But if I am trans and I am in the closet, I will not be able to use my correct pronouns. So either I'm being forced to misgender myself because of company policy. Like everybody has to have their pronouns in their bio for the sake of trans people. Meanwhile, myself as a trans person, I'm getting oppressed by this policy. So either I would have to lie, or either by commission or omission, or I'd have to out myself if I'm not comfortable. Of course, there are trans people who are comfortable coming out. That's not what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We're talking about people who are in the closet, including regard to their gender and how we're inundated with pronouns these days. Everyone has to have their pronouns, you know, because we're all so progressive, but it's actually counter-progressive to me because some of us cannot have our actual pronouns in our bio. Like I'll tell who I want to tell what my pronouns are.
Definitely, definitely. And I like related to this very, very strongly because I actually had an experience where I was accidentally outed by a well-meaning person because I had my pronouns in my bio, because my pronouns are he, him, she, her, they, them. I use all three because I'm polygender. And the person mentioned my pronouns and then went on like a huge diatribe about how because I'm non-binary, I use all these three pronouns. And I was like, like, I understand where you're coming from. You're trying to like, you know, like explain, but like you also just outed me to this group of people, you know, who I don't know, I can't trust. And from that moment on, I stopped completely using my pronouns because I was like, I don't want to go through this again.
Yeah.
And it was quite the experience, but it also like taught me like what you said, the privilege of pronouns, and it's a privilege that unfortunately I don't have access to.
Yeah, exactly. And like I'm not even just thinking about myself because I'm also non-binary and my pronouns are she, they, which I mean in the queer community I've sort of switched it to they, she, because I find that people completely disregard the non-binariness. They're like, yeah, she this and she that, you know, because my point is that I'm super feminine presenting, right? So I look like a she. And I have one of my pronouns is she. And on the one hand, people completely disregard it. So to the people who know me, I insist that my pronouns are they, she, even though I prefer she, they. Mm-hmm. But I want you to see me fully. But I was saying that I not only think about myself, I also think about like a friend of mine who's a trans woman who hasn't fully transitioned. And whenever we're out and about, like when it's just me and her, it's, you know, the she's and the hers are really flying. But when we're in public, like my mind has to race 1,000 miles a minute trying to make sure that she's safe. And I'm like, I have to call her him, like in front of other people, you know, like he wants this. And then I feel awful after, but I know I am doing it, but I don't know, you know, like it's not as black and white as just people want to make it. And I understand the privileged trans people who insist, like there are a lot of trans people who say, don't call me they if I've told you that my pronouns are he, him. And I get that. But I'm coming from a society where we're on the run. We in danger, girl. Mm-hmm. You know, so I have to use all sorts of variety to keep myself safe, to keep my friends safe, you know. It's so nice for you to be able to just be like, I'm he, him, and that's that. Or I'm she, her, and that's that. I'm like, I'm happy for you. But my reality is so much more nuanced than that.
Exactly. Yeah, and safety is of the utmost priority.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. So thank you so much for sharing so much about queerness, about elite capture, about the importance or lack thereof of coming out of the proverbial closet, the privilege of pronouns. Is there anything else that you want to get into before we start discussing queer African reads in the Queer Kenyan Book Club?
No, I feel like I've spoken about myself. I've spilled other people's tea. Like I've covered everything.
All right, then. We'll get into Queer African Reads. So Queer African Reads, as you said before, is your social media platform where you read queer African writers and you write reviews about their work. And I'd just like to know, how did it start? How's it going? And what did you intend with the platform?
Right. So I think how it started was that I was reading books and I was putting them on like my main Instagram. And I realized that, that's not where I should be putting books, and that there's a whole dedicated community of people who just post about books.
Bookstagrammers.
Exactly. Bookstagrammers, those iconic people. And I wanted to be a part of that community. But I think also when I was starting, like it ended up being like a wonderful nexus with me, like really doing a lot of reading and learning about my identity as a queer African person and wanting to share. Like I said back then, like as I was learning and as I was trying to debunk the whole homosexuality is an African thing, I wanted to share. So I was reading and reading and I'm like, oh, let me review this book and that book. And of course, I wasn't just reading queer African books. So I kept sharing everything that I was reading, like all the good books that I was reading. Or if a book was particularly inflammatory, I'd also share it. But on the whole, I try to only share books that I enjoy or books that I'm like, this shocked me negatively for this reason. So that's how it started. Where are we now? Like right now I'm fighting with the push towards Instagram Reels. Mm. I don't want to post a reel. Mm-hmm. I want to post a book review.
But Instagram is pushing those reels hard. Like
it's really pushing those reels. Like I went through a whole spiritual journey with Instagram. Like first teaching myself to stop caring about the number of likes because the likes were reducing significantly because reels are getting the priority.
I've noticed the same. My likes are reduced over time. Yeah,
exactly. So taking months off and telling myself it's just Instagram, it's not real life. And then coming back and posting and I'm like, I don't care if I get 100 likes. That's fine, you know. Mm-hmm. But I found that, I mean, this year I've only posted like once or twice, you know. I'm still posting on my book club page, but on my Queer African Reads page, I haven't been posting. And whenever I want to post, I feel like an urge to post a reel. So I think Instagram has gotten to me definitely. But yeah, the idea is to come back and keep reviewing books. I'm going to do that. I've read so many great books this year. I mean, I should share. Even if only 5 people get to see the post, I think I still want to share. So that's what happened. And then with the Queer Kenyan Book Club, it was just a bunch of us that came together and were like, yeah, we can read queer books and have like a Kenyan book club. This started during the pandemic, so it was online. As a result, we have like Kenyans in the diaspora, we have Ugandans in Uganda. It sort of didn't really stay as a Queer Kenyan Book Club, but we still call it that. But yeah, so it's still on Zoom or on Google Meet because people are all over the world. But we still try to keep it as Kenyan as possible because that was the original intention. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that just randomly started in 2020 and we've kept it going ever since.
That's great. And what sort of discussions have you had on the book club?
We only read books either written by a queer author or books with a queer theme. And I think because we've been running it for so long, keep having nostalgic conversations about like, our favorite book so far, like, oh my God, you remember when we read this book? And then we had a discussion, it was so great. So we definitely have our greatest hits, which I can mention a few, like Detransition Baby by Tori Peters, which, wow, that book is mind-blowing. It's complex, like it's written so beautifully. Tori Peters is brilliant. She has a brain and a half. And I love reading like trans people having like deep expository conversations about transness with themselves and with their audience, you know. Like whenever you hear the detransition conversation, it's often from like people who are like, you see, trans isn't real. We're just brainwashing little girl, you know. So to see a trans woman writing a book about detransitioning, it's a masterpiece, I have to say. Another book that we read that we absolutely loved was Butter Honey Pig Bread by Francesca. I forget her second name. Oh my God. She's a Nigerian author.
Ekwuasi? I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah. Francesca Ekwuasi. Oh, that book is beautiful. It's stunning. It has so many recipes. It's just a delicious book to read. We also enjoyed You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty by Akweke Emezi. That one we read like 2 months ago. It's such a messy book. Like, it's so messy. We highly recommend it in the book club. That's three books that I've mentioned. Let me give you two more. The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin. I mean, she can write anything. She can write a laundry list and I will read it. But like the way that she writes, like this friendship between these two men. Oh my God. Like, I was in tears. I rarely cry.
Wow.
But we were all like, the whole book club was like really touched by that book. It's so good. A fifth one. Let me think of a fifth one that we loved. An Unkindness of Ghosts by Rivers Solomon, who's a non-binary writer. We actually lean a lot towards sci-fi. We're trying to read less sci-fi. I think I've mentioned like three sci-fi books. But yeah, so it's about space. It's a really good book, but it's by a non-binary author. Yeah, I think I've mentioned mostly non-binary authors, but yeah. Yeah.
That sounds great. And that sounds like a great space. And are you open to new members if any listeners want to join?
Always. Yeah. Like, we're always, like, I get a lot of, because I'm the one who runs the book club page on Instagram. I just felt the need to start it. Like, I started it after a year of the book club just to document what we're doing. Like, not just let it, you know, happen without it having a space on the internet where it can live forever, where we can look back and say, look, between 2020 and 2050, I don't know, we ran this book club and these are the books that we read. So I was really keen on that. So I get a lot of messages on Instagram as people ask me if they can join. I mean, as running a book club is a very disappointing venture. Like, a lot of people who ask if they can join don't actually read along with us or don't come to our meetings. So we've ended up having a core group, like the same four or five people who will always be there. And then like a revolving door of like 20 other people who just come in and go out and never really participate. And sometimes it feels like maybe someone is an op. Like, why are you asking to join my book club? And then you never say anything. Mm-hmm. And this is like a safe space for queer people to read. So I'm always open to members, but I'm also always like kicking people out for non-participation. So I think what I would say, because I feel it feels unsafe when somebody comes in and doesn't participate. So I would say we are extremely open to new, like, queer Kenyan readers to join us, wherever you are, but you have to be willing to participate. You have to actually be an active member, not just someone who's lurking in the shadows, because we're not an ordinary book club. We're a book club with people who are in a protected group, you know?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. You got to protect people's safety above everything else.
Absolutely.
And could you shout out your Instagram handles for both Queer African Reads and the Queer Canon Book Club if people want to find more information, if listeners are interested in following your journey or potentially joining the book club?
Yes, I'm at Queer African Reads on Instagram, at African_queer on Twitter, and at queerafricanreads@gmail.com if you want to email me. For the book club, I only have the one page, which is at queer_Kenyan_book club. Yeah, so you can DM me there.
And that's on Instagram, correct?
That's only on Instagram.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Thank you so much for sharing that journey. That's how we initially connected. And it's been it's been a pleasure watching it grow and watching all the different writers that you've reviewed. And you're very, very honest with your reviews, which I appreciate. And like, you've given me a lot of great recommendations for reads and through both the book club and Queer African Reads. So you're doing a great service, and I'd just like to commend you for that.
Thank you. I'm so glad that like people actually see the resource for what it is. And like, I always just want to recommend good books to people. So I'm glad that it works to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to get into the penultimate question, the second last question of this interview. My question for you is, what was your first experience or most significant experience of queer joy?
Queer joy. I think honestly, not to just segue from one to the next, but I think like for me, books are a huge part of my life, probably my only hobby at this point. I think for me, a lot of queer joy exists in gathering with other queer people and having book club conversations around queer books or queer authors, and we're all queer, and it feels like a place of community, and I really enjoy it. I enjoy it so much. And at least it's something that I'm guaranteed will happen regularly, right? Like I can wait for it. And we can come together and hate a book, or we can come together and love a book. But the point is that we're together, we get together.
That sounds amazing. Yeah. A lot of people have spoken about the communities that they've been able to find with other queer people and how that brings them queer joy. So I'm glad that the book club has been able to bring that to you. All right, so we're down to our last question of the interview. What was your first memory of coming out to a trusted person and being celebrated?
Right. I have terrible memory. Consequently, I have no memory of coming out to anyone. Like, I don't even know who the first person that I came out to was.
Doesn't have to be the first person. It can be the most significant.
Yeah, I'm saying, like, I think the first one is quite a significant one that people have. And even that, I don't remember. So I don't think I remember. I think the coming out moments that I remember would be, or like that I have warm fuzzies about, would be coming out to my fellow queer friends, or even bringing my queer friends together. Mm-hmm. Like I've managed to combine my circles. So like my queer friends from when I was living in the UK and my queer friends from when I was living in Kenya, and sort of my friends from Kenya who are in the UK, I've been able to combine that into one big fat circle of queer people who know and love each other. And so, yeah, having them know who I am. And I think I also take a lot of pride in people finding me to be a safe space that they can come out to. So those friends coming out to me, I remember more than me coming out to them because of how it made me feel that my friends trusted me enough to sit me down and tell me this is who I am. Those I remember. My own, I don't remember. But what stands out to me always is the warmth and safety of coming to someone who is also queer like me and telling them like we're kin, and building really strong relationships from that.
That sounds amazing. That sounds like you've like been able to form such a trusting and loving and supportive community from both the UK and Kenya, and that they've been able to intersect, which is amazing.
The fact that they've been able to intersect is always shocking to me. I'm like, wow. Like these people are friends. Like they hang out so much. And somehow like I made that happen. It always shocks me so much.
That's amazing. I always love it when like I introduce a friend to another friend and then they become like even closer friends than I was with either one.
Exactly. Yeah. And like you're watching from the outside like a proud parent. Mm-hmm. I love it so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Could you speak more to your experiences of having people come out to you and creating that safe space for them? Because I have had that moment where somebody has come out to me and I wasn't sure like whether my reaction was appropriate. And so for our listeners' sake, I just wanted anybody listening to have the knowledge of basically how best to respond when somebody comes out to you.
Yeah, I think my method of response has definitely evolved with each coming out story that I receive, right? So if I think about like one of my first friends who told me that they were queer, my response was, yeah, I always knew, like, duh, you know, like you wear it on your sleeve. But now I find that what works for me and for my friends or for people who come out to me is for me to not make a big deal out of it, not to be like, you know, you're so gay, I always knew, mm-hmm. You know, which is like a lot of people do that. And that's seen as like normal, but I'm like, okay, is it like, it's like a giant red flag that someone is wearing, right? And you're like, we kept seeing this red flag. You're the only one who didn't know that it was showing, you know? So I find it more comforting to like the person coming out to just be like, yeah, okay, go on, you know? Like I hear that and it's a normal thing for me. It's not this, you're not like an outlier that everyone is zeroing in on, you know? Like if somebody came to you and said they're gay and your response is, I always knew, like, you act so gay. It's almost like there's a spotlight on them permanently. But if you come to me and say, I'm gay, and I'm like, yeah, okay, continue. Like, it's not a shocking thing that I was like, I saw it on you, like a stain, you know? So I find, yeah, I find like not calling attention to it and not acting like a big know-it-all. Like I always saw, like my gaydar is so strong. Is it that like that, that doesn't help anyone?
Definitely. I found the same in my experiences that when I treat it as something like, yeah, okay, that's cool. Yeah. Like, do you want to talk more about it? You know, like, and just normalize it as, you know, just like a day-to-day thing.
Yeah,
then that leads to like the trust that's established between myself and whoever the individual is, and also leads to just like better friendship and a better sense of the fact that like this thing which could have been weighing on them heavy, and me just treating it as a casual thing means that they can also start treating it as a casual part of their life.
Exactly. As opposed to like this big open secret, like they've been trying to hide it, but they weren't doing a good job of hiding it, you know?
Exactly.
Because when you call it out like that, it's like you were trying your best, but you failed at concealing your true identity, you know? I don't think I've ever thought about coming out as much as I just did in this moment. Like, I just realized that I have a really negative feeling about like when people come out and someone is like, we knew all along. Mm-hmm. I just realized I really don't like it.
Yeah, that was my coming out experience that we knew all along from a couple of people. And yeah, as a queer youth, I struggled so much with like coming to terms with what exactly my queer identity was, what exactly my gender identity was. And it was a very difficult process for me. And it was like, if you know all along, why didn't you help me with this process? Like exactly. That I've been struggling with like, for so long.
You've just been watching me struggle.
Exactly.
And also, I feel like it robs you of that moment. Because if you think about coming out and like the trepidation and you're gearing up to tell someone. And like you said, it's taken a long journey of you coming to terms with yourself. And finally, you feel like you're ready to tell someone. And they're like, yeah, I already knew. Like, what's new? Mm-hmm. It's like, yo.
Stole my thunder.
My moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been struggling so much with how to tell you this. And then I tell you, like, duh. You know?
Wholeheartedly agree.
This was One Foot in the Closet. If you'd like to support our podcast, please subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And please take the time to leave a rating and review, especially on Apple Podcasts. It really helps. We'd love to hear back from you. Wherever you're listening in from, please share your thoughts with us via email at onefootinthecloset@gmail.com. Like our Facebook page, One Foot in the Closet. Follow our Instagram @onefootincloset and follow our Twitter @onefootincloset. Please send any messages, thoughts, comments, and questions via social media or email. One Foot in the Closet was created by Name Redacted, hosted by Name Redacted, theme music by Annie King Smith, edited by Annie King Smith, mixed and produced by Drew Deacon Thomas. This project was funded by House of African Feminisms, a project of the Goethe Institute, Kigali, Lagos, and Johannesburg.